Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia. And with me, as always, is Jennifer Wollman. How about that? No descriptor.
No descriptor.
No, just sad. Jennifer Wollman.
The sad Jennifer Wollman. Hello, everybody.
Hello. So, Jennifer, what are we diving into today?
So, the counselors of real estate come out every year with their predictions, and usually they come out at the end of the year. So, they came out, the predictions for 2025 came out, I think, in September or October of 2024. So, I thought, being, you know, at the halfway point in June, that it would be a fun, or, well, I don't know if fun's the word, but it would be interesting to compare their predictions to what is actually going on right now in the South Florida commercial real estate market. And that's all, folks. That's what I was thinking.
I was waiting. I was waiting.
I know.
I was giving you wait time.
Nothing else. But, those were my thoughts.
You know, we've done this before. I always find it really interesting because they really do a deep dive into, you know, all of these 10 issues, and it's really interesting to see the dynamics of how they go from year to year and how they shift. And then if you look 10 years back, then it kind of gives you a little bit of a sense of how things evolve. So, you know, I always like this. In the top 10 issues, how would you like to do it? Would you like to go from 10 to, well, to
yeah,
1?
Yeah, let's do it the way that they do it. They go from 10 to 1, and it might not reflect the order of importance in Southeast
for
Florida,
everybody,
but we can
right.
talk about that as well,
exactly.
too, if we want.
So this, the first one, or the, I guess the 10 number on 10. The list, mm-hmm. number 10, is price expectations gap. I think this is really interesting. We've been talking about this, that there is definitely a gap between the expectations of the sellers and the buyers that has grown larger. And at first, they're really talking about price depreciation of certain assets that are finally, you know, decelerating in their decline. And they focus specifically on the C, B, and D class offices. But that the pricing shock, you know, that lowering of the price has been dissipating.
We definitely are seeing that here, right? And we had an interview with our dear friends from Blanca Real Estate, who right. specialize in office in Southeast Florida. And they did a really good job of saying that doesn't necessarily apply to us. East Florida has been doing extremely well, at least on the leasing side. And for certain assets on, you know, Class A office is still doing really well in terms of transactions. Yeah. So this is mostly for the Class B and C office space and further out, right? Not necessarily the Class A urban core markets.
No, I mean, certainly we're in a different marketplace. We've spoken about this, you know, ad nauseum, especially when you're looking at the office market in South Florida and how significantly it differs from the averages around the nation and from some states around the nation. And we'll get to why that's important to anyone, whether you are a commercial investor or not. But, you know, one of the things that they mention here is that buyers are still wary of overpaying for an asset in a market where interest rates are higher. So definitely the rates, you know, I think for the last 2 years, everyone has been wrong about what's going to happen with rates, right? We've gotten all these assumptions that there's going to be 3, 4, or 5 cuts that then go down to 2 and 1 and 3. You know, it's really all over the place. But one of the things that the counselors of real estate mentioned in this gap is that we are getting to a point where, and they mention in another area, they give it its own standalone theme, but how the maturity of the loan, the upcoming big wave of loan maturities that are coming up are might push both sides together, even going as far as saying that owners that are facing a costly refi will have to make some tough decisions. And, you know, we'll have to have a wait and see approach. Again, we don't think that this is going to happen in a significant scale here in South Florida.
Correct. And we did have some the first quarter of 2025. Granted, a lot of these deals were probably under contract at the end of 2024. But we did have an increase in the number of office transactions up to almost $1 billion. We're at 0.9 billion, which was an increase of 185% from the year previously, the same quarter of 2024. So we are seeing sales volume increase, and a lot of that is due not just to the distress, but I think also to that price gap narrowing that you discussed.
Absolutely. I think that it's really interesting how this feeds into number 9 on the list, which has to do with office vacancies, which is the reason why there is this price depreciation on C and B and D offices. But it also ties it to the tax base and the health of urban cores around the nation. And this is really interesting. So according to some of the stats that is quoted in this report, U.S. vacancy rate for office, or I guess overall U.S. vacancy rate on commercial real estate, is expected to have peaked at 19.7% by the end of 2024. Again, that is, you know, significantly higher than where we are in South Florida. But it's important to note that there are other places where not a lot of progress has been made over the last 2 years, especially in office. New York City, for example, the attendance rate of people that are coming back into the office is still at 50%. I'm not saying that that's the vacancy rate,
right,
but as far as the people that are actually going to the office, it hasn't really moved from that. That means that half of your employees, you're leasing out a space for the full office to be able to work, but only 50% are attending. And maybe some attend for these 3 days, some others attend 2 days, you know, that kind of a thing. The other thing is that what's important to cities is that urban centers have long relied on office buildings for their contributions to the tax base. And the daytime office population drives the bigger real estate ecosystem, because now you need to have a place to eat your lunch.
Hotels for guests coming in. Right.
Correct. So it has definitely a place. And for that, I wanted to bring something up that a friend of ours, Robert Palacios with Regency Commercial Properties, brought up to me. He sent me, we actually discussed it in person, but it's an article from U.S. News and Report about Boston homeowners are facing a $1 billion tax bill. So I wanted to just, you know, tell you a little bit about this, that basically thousands of Boston homeowners received a bigger than expected tax bill, in large part because the Boston office buildings have tumbled in value by more than 50% in some cases since 2019. And if you're an urban center and in the urban core, you're relying on that tax in order to provide all the services to your city, right? And that goes down by 50%. That is a huge hit to the cities, and the cities have to make it up in one way or another. So all this conversation about what are we doing or what are we going to do with these office buildings, it's not only about how that affects to that individual investor or that institutional investor that owns the property. It's how does that affect the tax base of those cities and of those urban centers, especially when you're seeing that the values have shifted tremendously. So basically, they're saying that Boston has lost about $1 billion worth of taxable value, and that burden, they have to find a way to make it up in another way. You know, they give a couple of examples. There was a property, a lending group in March took ownership of One Lincoln, which is a 1.1 million square foot office tower for for $400 million in a foreclosure auction. The tower had been refinanced for $1 billion in 2022. So in that 2-year span, that's, I mean, that is just a crazy thing to happen, you know, and the changes in valuation. So, you know, and in the article, they talk about time for creative thinking, and it definitely is a situation. So there are urban cores in our country that are going to go through this process of figuring out how do we make up that difference.
Well, and I think that, and we can get into it later because it also happens to be a topic on things to look for further down in their report. But you have to be careful because if the cities try to get all of that from the homeowners, then and other property owners, right? Then that means the cost of owning a home, a retail space, or a multifamily property in that area is going to become more expensive, which then it becomes a cycle, right? Well, then if it's so much more expensive to live in Boston and I don't have this office dynamic infrastructure, then where's cheaper? Because income taxes in Boston are also extremely high.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So you start You're getting into right. that loop, and then that's why I'm always fearful when cities and counties and states start looking at taxing issues and playing with it too much. You know, my big thing would be go cut, whatever you need to cut, and figure out creative ways to bring people back into the city versus taxing and putting all of the burden on the people who stayed. Because if you put all of the burden on the people and businesses who stayed, you're going to drive out more people.
No, for sure. And, you know, it's an important conversation that is not going to go away. And part of the conversation, and we hear it all the time in our circles, is, well, can we convert the office buildings to multifamily? Well, the reality is that because of the way that they were built, it's incredibly expensive. And there are many investors that have looked at throughout this country whether that is an option, you know, but the numbers just don't pencil out because the cost of acquiring the building would have to be significantly low in order for you to even begin to consider that process. And so unless there are other incentives, either from the federal government or at the state and local level, to create or to bridge that gap of the cost of doing that conversion, it's going to be very, very difficult. I think a lot of investors that we've spoken to and that we've heard speak in conferences have basically just, you know, they evaluate those deals every day and it just doesn't make
right. There are very few. Right. Just think of the plumbing, right? If you look at your typical building, you don't have bathrooms in every single office building. It's usually a shared office. You know, it's a shared bathroom in the common area spaces, et cetera, and just bringing all that plumbing in.
No, the plumbing stack is it's a huge part of the expense for sure.
All right. And number 8, sustainability.
Yeah. I only have one thing to say about this, which is that to me, that's the word has become so boring because it's like, oh, sustainability, we're going to talk about being green, all stuff. But that's not really what it is. It's incredibly important because what they're really referencing here is having buildings that are future ready to be more energy efficient, more resilient, but more importantly, more resilient to an environment where we are seeing a higher frequency of extreme weather events that are on the rise. So this, to me, kind of melts with something else that we're going to see later, which has to do with insurance costs.
Correct.
You know, so the sustainability of the building has a direct relationship with what is it going to cost for you to insure that building?
Well, and look, we get hammered all the time here in Miami and in Southeast Florida as being kind of the bullseye and the, you know, canary in the coal mine, whatever description you want to use. But because of that, and because of our experience with flooding and Hurricane Andrew, we actually, as a region, had to become resilient way sooner than it became a buzzword. And so we do have the Southeast Florida Regional Compact, which is a partnership between Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, Palm Beach counties to deal with the issues of climate change, sustainability, et cetera. And the state of Florida also is very well aware of the issues that affect us, and they have grants that are available to help with it's called the Resilient Florida Program, that are available to counties, municipalities, and special districts within those to help make an area more sustainable / resilient. So, yes, you know, I constantly look at, oh my gosh, you know, what's going to happen to Southeast Florida or Florida in general? We're surrounded by water on three sides, you know, and
yeah, people don't come here for the mountains.
Exactly. But and so we've got all of this beautiful water, which makes our lifestyle amazing. We also have a very shallow groundwater table in Southeast Florida, and limestone rock, which is very porous. So it's easy for stuff to come up during heavy rain events. But the reality is that those challenges also provide for incredible opportunities for creative thinking. And we have a lot of developers across all sectors who are building sustainable and resilient projects throughout Southeast Florida.
Absolutely. Well, the next one is artificial intelligence, your favorite topic.
I'm artificially intelligent. I make stuff up, which is kind of very much like AI.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, you had to have enjoyed the focus of this article, because it really was about good data in, good data out, bad data in, bad data out. And what they're really talking about is that the accuracy, the granularity, the timeliness of that data lies at the core of why, of where, you know, of the value that real estate might see from AI. But unless the input accuracy is there, then we're going to get bad input. And they mentioned really the collective, you know, concern about AI from a perspective of data analyzation and when it comes to making decisions in real estate, specifically commercial real estate, is how good is the data? How useful are the decisions that are going to arise from that data? You know, if you have the wrong information and you make the right decision, but you made the right decision with that wrong information, then you made the wrong decision. And so that's definitely a concern. There was something else here that I thought was really interesting, because we had a conference earlier this year where they spoke about data centers. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of data centers. It's definitely driving some markets. But I found this analogy interesting. I don't know if you dove into this, but I thought it was really cool, because they're saying that one of the challenges with the data centers is that an AI algorithm cannot be serialized. And I love this analogy. A good analogy, and I'm going to read it verbatim, is the Clark Griswold string of holiday lights. If one bulb went out, the entire string didn't work.
They're the ones responsible for my Christmas tree frustrations. Okay.
No, because now they learn to serialize it so that if one bulb doesn't work, the rest of the lights would still function, right? And you don't have to go checking every single light. You know which is the light that goes out. But they don't have the technology to do that for AI algorithms, which is why it requires so much computing power, right? And because it requires a lot of computing power, it is yielding this demand of having data centers. But what if they figure it out, which is what they're working on, where you can serialize it and you can segment it so that it doesn't require all of that computing power to ask a question that should be reserved to one area, you know? And now the demand for that, for all that data centers may suffer. So it's an interesting dynamic. And again, you know, these reports, it's really about looking into the future. And again, these are issues that they're looking top 10 issues in commercial real estate, but they're not thinking, well, these are the top 10 issues this year. No, these are the top 10 issues moving forward.
And for me, the most exciting thing about AI and how it affects commercial real estate, because individual brokers and users are going to use it however they see fit for their operations and how they run their business. But for me, I think the biggest impact that AI can have, especially in South Florida, and you guys are going to get sick of hearing, well, you're probably already sick of hearing me say it, but yeah. So what is in being able to streamline the processes across the counties. Like we are so integrated as a region with Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County, but our zoning is anything but, our permitting process is anything but, and that is what excites me the most, because I think if the government entities could get together just like they did for the Resiliency Compact and create something where they're going to standardize as much as possible, at least the processes for zoning and permitting, it's going to make things so much easier. And you and I have spoken about this before, you have a tenant who is started business in Miami-Dade County. They're a local business. They're growing. They're expanding. But their original permitting process that they had in Little Havana is right. Totally different from their expansion into Pinecrest, which is totally different from their expansion into Broward County, into Palm Beach County. And that lack of efficiency and that complete disarray in the permitting process, to me, that's dollars. That's dollars for this municipality. It's dollars for the landlord, and it's dollars for the tenant that is being wasted and could be utilized so much better if the process were streamlined. So there, I'm off my soapbox.
And time is money.
Exactly.
And that's the big component. And it actually yields very much into the next one, which is housing affordability and attainability. And this is where, let's not dive into it too much. We've had a lot of conversations about this, but I think suffice it to say, there is not a magic pill here. There's not a one size fits all approach. This is we have to approach it from every angle, including, to your point, you know, removing that barrier to development and to growth. We know that the only solution is we need more units, and we need to build more efficiently. We shouldn't have to wait 18 months to go through the permit process and all that other stuff in order to raise a building.
Well, and I think the affordability crisis, this is where I think the issue ties into the taxing issue that we were discussing earlier in Boston's case, is that everywhere, it's affordable housing, I think, is a universal crisis in the United States. I think it's pretty much in every major city. And if we start trying to tax or overtax the people, and that's a big issue in our current legislative session, is what to do with property taxes, how to manipulate them, how to make it more affordable for property owners, etc. But once you start tweaking that, you have to be very careful, because what sounds good in theory, when you move it further down the road and you look at the big picture, can actually have a negative effect on that, right? Could work reverse order.
Absolutely.
Number five, insurance costs skyrocket.
Well, I know we're going to put a link.
Again, universal.
Right. I know we're going to put a link to this report, because you're going to get basically a breakdown. It's a one page or so breakdown of every one of these topics. And you're going to find a lot of you know, important information. Last year, again, insurance is, you know, they're in the business of managing risk,
right?
And so when you look at last year, it was another record-breaking year for damaging global natural disasters. And why do we mention global? Because we are all tied to a global market, which is the reinsurance market. Because of what all of these insurance companies do is they want to diversify their risk, right? They don't want to take on 100% of the risk. But you have $380 billion globally in economic losses from natural disasters. Only about 31% of those were covered by insurance. This is according to the Aon's 2024 Climate and Catastrophe Insight Report, which comes out every year. I think you're going to find in this report something really interesting, which is that a few years back, Florida addressed tort reform when it came to insurance. We're seeing a signs of relief and stabilization of the market. We may not even have an insurance market if it wasn't for that. But I find it interesting that that is what's happening and what everybody is talking about in California, that there is need for tort reform. There is dozens of these things called habitability lawsuits that are filed every day. And the California law says, so even if this is not even about tort reform when it comes to insurance, this is tort reform when it comes to managing multifamily property, right? If the plaintiff is successful in their claim, even if they're only paid out a dollar, you are responsible for paying out all of their attorney's fees, which, you know, could be just detrimental. So again, I mean, I'm sorry to be hitting on California. It's a beautiful state, but you know, You start looking at some of these government legislation and you're like, how does anybody do business? It's just crazy.
Well, and I think, and we did a great interview with Jamie Levinson on insurance in our area. So you guys really go and listen to that. But so this item, number five, insurance costs really piggybacks on the sustainability issue, because that's something that we're seeing too. Not all properties are created equal in Florida. And we talked about this already. It's not just Florida, it's throughout the country, but with the look back periods for flood insurance, et cetera. If you have a property that is in a flood zone and it's their the elevation level isn't high enough, then new construction that is built to the newer flood elevation levels obviously is going to be more insurable than something else. So again, they tie into the sustainability, and that'll help decrease.
Data is going to become an important component, because I think what owners are realizing is that they have to. So definitely that episode with Jamie is tremendous. You got to have somebody like that to make sure that you have, you're right sizing the coverage, you're assessing your deductibles, you're making sure that you're getting what you want out of it. You're not overpaying. And I think we're going to see new models come out as to how to properly evaluate replacement cost and all those things. I think there was a quote in here about how CoreLogic estimates in the industrial assets that there may be 30% higher, the estimates may be 30% higher than what the typical replacement costs are going to be for an asset class like that. So, you know, really, really interesting.
Well, and then the construction costs, you know, all factor into that, right?
Yeah, correct.
So, and they've gone up so much in the last several years. So,
yeah, no doubt.
Number four, geopolitics and regional wars.
Yeah.
We live in a risky world and we need to pay for it.
Yeah, for sure. Because all that risk is being priced. It's being priced into, you know, into the interest rates. Investors are pricing it into their cap rate. The way that they value a property is being priced into that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they do say that, you know, with this geopolitical risk, that, you know, the U.S. has always been a safe haven, and people that are looking for safety tend to park their money in the U.S. And that has a very real impact on our commercial real estate prices. We haven't seen that much. And a lot of those people, and we've seen that a lot in Southeast Florida, is especially in Central and South America, whenever there's big political change one way or another, we tend to see a flight here. And they're not buying based on cap rates. They're not buying, right? Their reason for buying is strictly capital preservation.
And then we go to the one that we mentioned prior, but which has to do with the loan maturities on commercial real estate loans and the debt repricing. According to TREP, which we quote often, they have awesome data. According to TREP, nearly $1.8 trillion in commercial real estate loans are set to mature before the end of 2026. We've spoken about this before. Many of the loans in 2023 that were set to mature were pushed to 24, were pushed again to 25. you know, we get to a point where the banks are like, we have to have a permanent solution to this.
Right, but the banks learned during the great financial crisis that they really didn't want to be taking back properties and being responsible for owning and managing them. So they really are trying to work out. You might have to bring in some more cap, you know, some more money, some more equity into the deal.
But when you're dealing with for example, an asset like the one in Boston that we mentioned that goes from a $1 billion refinance, which means that it had to be valued significantly higher for you to get a refinance loan of $1 billion. And now it's a $400 million, you know, value. This is where there are people that are going to have to make some tough decisions. And we've already seen it in some places like D.C., Atlanta. There are some of these things that are trading at a significant below replacement value at this point.
Remember that one office building in San Francisco that was like pennies on the dollar. Yeah, and that's why also we expect trade volume to increase, because as that starts to happen, I mean, there are a lot of buyers waiting on the sidelines. Personally, I don't think it's going to be as big an issue in the long run, because I think most of these are going to get worked out. People are going to come in and buy or add into the deal. But yeah, it's definitely something to look out for. And, you know, those buyers are motivated. Buyers are motivated to go in at the right price to get those deals and reposition them. And we're seeing that here in South Florida with buildings like the condo, right? We had a lot of the condos that are so expensive based on all the new laws. They haven't been maintained, you know, and now they need to get their recertification and their SEER study, and the amount of deferred maintenance is so, so high that the building itself is not worth anything compared to the value of the land. Right. So that's one of those examples where eventually a buyer is going to come along and the sellers are going to be like, we need out because we still have equity in our units. We don't want to come out of pocket for these massive assessments for a property that's outdated. And
for sure.
All right. Next, cost of financing.
The last two. Cost of financing. Yeah. I mean, you know, rates haven't really moved. As I mentioned before, I think people had a very different expectation of where the rates were going to be by this time.
Right. And I think that there's so much just going on, that instability, that I think the Fed is playing it safe, and rightfully so, because I think it would be better for the markets to kind of just adjust to the fact that this is where rates are for now. And eventually they might go down, but these are where rates are for now. We're going to have to make our decisions, rather than have the Fed cut rates prematurely, have us set off exorbitant inflation again, because let's be real, some areas we still have really high inflation, right? Groceries are still extremely high, right? I think housing is unaffordable. It's still really high. If you drop those and do a mad rush into housing, that's going to drive up prices even more. So I think the Fed is playing it smart. I know commercial real estate doesn't like hearing that. I know they want the lower capital, but I think doing it too fast, too soon would be more detrimental to commercial real estate in the short term and long term than to have this be status quo for a while until everything stabilizes and the uncertainty settles down, and then do the cuts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that to your point, I think we're at a point where buyers can only stay on the sidelines for so long. They have to make decisions. And sellers have had a lot of appreciation over the last 4 or 5 years at an accelerated rate in some cases. But there are other cases, like in the office sector, where they're underwater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a significant issue. So.
And then the final one, which is a little outdated because, again, they do this in 2024. It's global and U.S. elections. But this was their number one, their top kind of thing to look for in 2025. Yeah. And I think that their first statement, or the title of their first paragraph, basically states exactly where we are today. And that is that the only certainty is the uncertainty. And that's why everything is kind of in a flux. And to our point earlier with the with the credit and the interest rates and everything else is uncertainty. You know, the markets hate uncertainty of any kind. And across all of these sectors, things are still pretty uncertain. So,
yeah, I think, you know, at this point, it would be more of a conversation about the tariffs and how those negotiations are going. Will they have a long term effect? Are we going to, you know, experience short-term pain, long-term gains? Definitely what's happening with the tax bill and the extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are going to have, you know, probably more of an effect. So, you know, if you look at that last one, instead of looking at it as U.S. elections, it's more about, you know, really U.S. governance and policy and what it's going through. And that is always going to be, you know, I think at the forefront of, you know, it's certainly going to be one of the issues, I think, moving forward over the next 4 years.
Well, in elections in other countries, right? Because especially where we are, we're so international that what happens in other parts of the world greatly affect us. Exactly. We've seen that with the Canadians and the issues with Canada. And some of that comes from our leadership for sure, but some of it also comes from their leadership and how their leader reacted to the tariffs. So all of that all comes into play, and it makes it so much fun and so interesting, and why our job is never the same from one day to the next.
Exactly right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us on another episode of Between Two Chairs. I hope you have found this valuable. Want to encourage you to share it with others and like and subscribe, because my marketing person is going to kill me if I don't start saying those things. So thank you.
By the way, I'm not the marketing person.
No. We're blaming it on somebody else. I love it. Shout out to Giselle. All right, guys. All the best. Thank you very much. Say bye, Jennifer.
Bye.